Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you, as always, for joining us as we continue our crawl through the big old binder of baseball cards. And we are right in the middle of the 1960s. After the epic 1965 top set, which we featured on our podcast last week, we take a look at a classic but certainly not epic 66 top set, at least in my opinion. I know some other collectors really enjoy the 66 top set. In my opinion, similar to the 64 top set. There's a lot of good things about it, but it just doesn't have the wow factor that 65 had. But 66 tops, still a very solid set, very popular set. And our random pull, card number 119, Art Shamsky. And you may have heard that name somewhere, Shamsky. If you watch the TV show Everybody Loves Raymond, you've heard Shamsky. That was the name of Raymond's dog, which doesn't seem like much of a compliment for the real Art Shamsky. But Art Shamsky was a pinch hitter extraordinaire, great left-handed pinch hitter, had quite a bit of pop in his bat, a member of the 1969 Miracle Mets, and a very interesting story, not only during his playing career, but after. Yes, there is more to Art Shamsky than being named after Ray Romano's bulldog, or having Ray Romano's bulldog named after him, I should say. But we'll talk about Art Shamsky and the 66 top set in just a moment after we talk about what you're talking about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. A lot of comments about the most recent new podcast from last week, the 65 top set. And as I said in the podcast, quite possibly my favorite set of all time. And that's saying a lot. But if you listen to the podcast, you know that I like the photography. I like the design. I like the little mini pennant with the team crest. I won't even call it a logo because they were really using like a more regal kind of secondary logo. I call it a crest. And then the backs of the cards were great. And we had a lot of people who were right in line with what I was thinking with that podcast. Also, our random poll, Tony Oliva, who should be in the Hall of Fame. After all, he is just a career 304 hitter. And as I mentioned in that podcast, not only escaping Cuba, but also having a lot of success as an all-star player. His career cut short because of knee injuries. But John Sharp joining in with commentary saying, agreed. For a long time, I thought he was in the Hall of Fame. No, John, he's come close. In fact, the most recent Veterans Committee vote, which is back in 2014, he came painfully close to getting into the Hall of Fame, just missed it. And of course, when you have some much beloved players or coaches or managers, as the case may be, just missed, there's a big outcry. And there actually was a big, big outcry, especially, of course, in the Twin Cities about Oliva not getting in. I believe the committee meets again, I want to say this December. So there is a chance that Tony Oliva could finally get into the Hall of Fame. I hope he does, because like I said, not just a career 304 hitter, not just a ton of all-star appearances with the Twins throughout the mid to late 60s and into the early 70s, but he was very influential on the Minnesota Twins team that was successful, that won World Series in 1987 and 1991, a key component in the development of Kirby Puckett, who is in the Hall of Fame, and still a big part of the Twins organization, has been since day one. So hopefully he does get into the Hall of Fame as he is still active with Minnesota and still a big, big part of Twins fandom throughout Minnesota. Snug Collectibles jumps in and says, high five, the 1965 set design has always been a favorite. Subscribing to your show today. Well, thank you, and thank you, Snug Collectibles, for your commentary and for subscribing to the show as well. And I just have to get the word out there as Snug Collectibles of Santa Monica, California, snugcomics.com, by the way, mentions jumping on board with the subscription to the program. You can listen to Wax Ecstatic on Audio Boom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, or TuneIn. And if you listen on any preferred platform, go ahead and subscribe to the RSS feed. It'll come straight into your inbox, if you will, or straight to your mobile device every time our new shows come up on Tuesday mornings at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. But also comment on it, rate us. You know, every platform is a little different, but give us 5 stars, say good things about us on the platform. So if you follow on iTunes, you can, you know, say good things about us there. If you follow along with Audio Boom, you could say good things about us on there. Wherever you primarily listen to us, subscribe, comment, rate us, and that will actually help us get the word out on the podcast even more. It's just like Facebook. You know, if you follow the metrics of Facebook, the more post likes that a post get, the more shares that a post get, the more comments that a post gets, that basically ramps up the algorithm within Facebook to make that post show up in more and more people's timelines. It's a very selective process here. Same thing here. So again, if you follow us on Audio Boom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, or Stitcher, that's your primary platform for listening to us. Subscribe, follow along, comment on us, rate us, and help us get the word out about the Wax Ecstatic podcast. With those new podcasts on Tuesdays and the Flashback Friday editions. We'll talk about our Flashback Friday edition in just a moment, but one last thought about 65 Tops from Mike Echo. Echo. See what I did there? Yeah, it was just too easy. Mike Echo says 65 Tops are the best. And again, you know, if you ask what's my favorite set in my lifetime, well, I'm not old enough to be alive in 1965, so it falls short there. But of all time, 65 Tops is right up there with 87 Tops, 83 Tops as well. And especially if you're just looking at the top sets, there's, you know, 4 or 5 that I would put at the absolute top of the list. And if 65 Tops isn't at the number one position, because sometimes my mind changes, but if it's not the number one position, I would almost put it in the box trifecta. It's definitely going to be top three, as the case may be. All right, now speaking of Flashback Friday editions, our most recent Flashback Friday show from a few months back, focusing on 86 Fleer, as we were right in the middle of our big old Monster Box programs. And we looked at 86 Fleer. Our random pull from that set was Dave Henderson. And 86 was a big year for Dave Henderson, mostly because he was released from the torture that playing for the Seattle Mariners in 1986 was. A big trade that landed him in Boston with the Red Sox. And Handu would turn out to be a great player for Boston for a few years, would later move on to Oakland, would win a World Series with Oakland in 1989 over San Francisco, and had a very good career. And in that podcast, I lamented about how Dave Henderson was almost a legendary star. He should have a statue outside of Fenway Park erected in his memory, had it not been for the goof up by Bill Buckner in Game 6 of the 86 World Series. And of course, the part that most people forget about that World Series, the Red Sox blowing a lead late in the Game 7 to the Mets. People forget there was a Game 7, and they also forget that the Red Sox were winning up until, I believe it was the 7th inning of that game. But of course, the Mets come back, and it's the amazing Mets of 86, and we remember that script well. But Dave Henderson had that crushing home run against the late Donnie Moore in the American League Championship Series. Remember, the Angels were just one strike away from moving on to the World Series. Well, Henderson put that away, and he had a phenomenal postseason. And if it wasn't for that goof up in Game 6 by Buckner and for the Red Sox not being able to hold on to a lead in Game 7, Dave Henderson would have been able to walk on water in Boston. And God rest his soul, he was a great player, but unfortunately doesn't quite get the credit that he deserves. And same with the 86 Fleer. You know, that's one of those sets that kind of gets lost in the hands of time, because when you think of 86 baseball cards, the first set you think of is Topps, of course. I wasn't a big fan of the Topps design that year, but that's normally the first card people think of. And of course, the Donruss set, because you had the Jose Canseco rookie card in the 86 Donruss set, and that really drove that set, still does, even though the value of the set has come down significantly in the last 30 or so years. That card can still fetch a few dollars if you pull that from a box. Well, Ryan Stonebreaker jumps in to say, I always enjoy this podcast. The 10-year-old in me is firing up this podcast this morning. Still have many 86 FLIR cards. Well, thank you again, Ryan, for following us and for firing up the flashback episode. And I wish I had more 86 FLIR cards. I don't, but I'm sure I can track them down in lots or find a box cheap enough somewhere. I actually saw in a local card shop not too long ago a box of 86 Donruss, actually a couple boxes of 86 Donruss that I was very tempted to buy. The price was a few dollars higher than what I wanted, but at least I know it's there. And because not that many people are clamoring for the junk wax era cards like I am, I'm probably the only one in the neighborhood looking for 86 Donruss, so I'll probably be able to get my hands on that. All right. Thanks again to all who have chimed in at Wax and Gum Stains. Again, I implore you, listening to this podcast, spread the word about Wax and Gum Stains, our Twitter feed. It's open 24/7. You could talk about our podcast, the sets we talk about, the players we talk about, or just anything in the hobby. And it's a fun follow because it's just this open forum, and it's amazing some of the cards that people post, some of the memories as well. And your comments may be used in our podcast. So that's always a nice little thing there as well. And don't forget, Audio Boom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher. That's how we get the podcast out to you. The new episodes come out on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. Eastern. And our Flashback Friday episodes come out Fridays at 10 a.m. Eastern. And then we'll send out a tweet every now and then throughout the weekend just to remind you about those Flashback episodes from a few months back when we were going through the Monster Box. And now we're going through the Binder. Now, before we turn the page on the Binder onto our next set, I also want to remind you, if you would like to contribute to the well-being of Wax Ecstatic, you can do so by sending us a little tip, giving us a couple bucks. Please, sir, could I have some more? Yes, you can do so at paypal.me/waxecstatic. I should say backslash. I know if you put in slash Wax Ecstatic, then you get a page that says, oops, something's wrong here. So we tweet out that link a couple times a week. I don't want to hit you over the head with it. But I do want to let you know there are some production costs involved in this podcast. There's also some time. I am not getting rich off this thing. Ooh, trust me, I'm not making money hand over fist on it. I never intended to. This is a labor of love. I just love talking about these cards and the players and the teams involved and my memories of card collecting and kind of getting back into the hobby in the last few years. So it's a labor of love. I'm not looking to get rich off this, but if you like what we do and you want to give us a couple bucks, 20 bucks, 200 bucks, $5, 10 cents, whatever, we appreciate all donations and the tips that we have received so far. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Of course, you can tip more than once. But if you would like to help us keep this thing going, any amount is appreciated, and I greatly, greatly thank you for doing so. Also, tips keep us from diving into the greasy world of advertising. You know, we're still open to the idea of having a title sponsor or a couple of advertisers. If there's a business or a service, a product or service that you have or know somebody who has that would fit in well with our listeners, I can share all sorts of information with you, get you in for a good price. And, you know, we can get a couple commercial messages in here, but the commercial free way and without charging a subscription fee, of course, is through the tip jar. So again, if you got a couple bucks to spare or a little more, again, for the, you know, I say a couple bucks for the price of a case of 88 Donruss, you can keep Wax Ecstatic going. paypal.me/waxecstatic. And again, thank you to all those who have already contributed, and hopefully we get a few more people to do so as well so we can keep this thing humming along here throughout the next few months. All right, let's get this podcast humming along with our look at 66 Tops. Again, a set that I like, but I don't love. I've never really embraced it fully for a number of reasons, and the biggest reason why I haven't is coming after the tremendous 65 Tops set. 66 Tops leaves a lot to be desired. Now, with that said, this is not a bad set. In fact, it's a pretty sharp set. It's a very simple set. But it is one of those sets where, again, when you put one set next to the other in a chronological order, it just dips down a little bit. very similar to what 64 Tops did after the great sets that were produced in 62 and 63. It's just kind of like, okay, it's good, but not great. 66 Tops is definitely in that boat. And I likened how 65 Tops and 87 Tops are two of my favorite sets of all time. And there's a similar fallout to the following set. 65 Tops was great. 66 Tops was good, but not great. 88 Tops is very similar to 66 Tops in two ways. Not only because it followed a great set, so it was kind of limited in the wow factor, but also in design. I mean, you look at 88 Tops and 66 Tops, there's a lot of similarities, especially with the kind of the beauty pageant sash look that you get here in the team name. And the 66 Tops set, the team name is on this diagonal strip in the upper left-hand corner of the card, while in 88 Tops, the player's name was in a diagonal strip in the lower right-hand corner. So you had some elements that kind of looked alike. That's kind of neat. But I think a big factor in why 66 Tops doesn't quite live up to 65 Tops is in terms of design and sizzle and wow, and just the look and feel of the card, not quite there. Now, there are some other factors why collectors aren't big on 66 Tops, and the big one, especially when it comes to some of these vintage sets, are rookie cards. 65 Tops, you had a ton of great rookie cards. 66, not so much. So 65, you have Steve Carlton, Tony Perez, Joe Morgan. 66, you've got some big names, but they just didn't quite have the impact. So probably the biggest rookie card in the 66 top set, Ferguson Jenkins, Hall of Famer, and a great Canadian pitcher, you also have Jim Palmer and Don Sutton. After that, the rookie class dips down significantly. Now, this is also a ding against 66 Tops with 67 Tops. While the design of 67 Tops wasn't that great, in my opinion, you had some really big rookies, none bigger than Tom Seaver, also Rod Carew in there as well. But 66 Tops, you've got a limited rookie class, so that kind of holds it back a little bit. Also, you've got a lot of double printed cards. So you not only had the usual problems with some of the card sets that were made in the 1960s, mostly cards being off center or just being poorly cut, or you would have the occasional faded print run. You know, some cards were not as vibrant as others. That was the case in 66 Tops. Plus, you had several cards that, for whatever reason, the way that Tops sequenced them, they went through the system a couple of times, so the value of these cards comes down, including some pretty notable stars. Mickey Mantle, the biggest one. There is a much larger proportion of Mickey Mantle cards compared to pretty much every other card in the set. So the 66 Tops Mantle is valued a little less than some of the other cards in this era for the Mick. But also, of course, you know, Mantle's career was winding down here. So naturally, the value is going to be down in the first place. But the fact that there's a few thousand extra cards that are out there, that's going to bring it down a little bit. Also, Pete Rose, a notable double print in this set. And Rose was at the other end of the spectrum. His great career was just starting. And of course, his rookie card, 1963, a big rookie card, his first year card, or I shouldn't say his first year card, is his second card, but his first solo card, where it's just Pete featured, was in 1964. So his career is just taking off. But again, like Mantle, there's a few thousand extra Rose cards that are out there, so the value comes down just a little bit. Still, there's value to it. I mean, you can get a pretty penny for some of these cards, but it may not be as high as some people would anticipate for basically a fourth year Pete Rose card or one of the final Mickey Mantle cards that came out. But other than the double printing and the usual problems that you had in some vintage sets, this is actually a pretty solid set in terms of the content of the players that are in there. Of course, some of the greatest players that you have playing in the 1960s or players who would become stars in the early 1970s, you had some early cards or rookie cards in here. You also had some of the legends like Mantle, that, you know, their careers were starting to wind down. So some of the big stars from the 1950s you had in here. Also a very interesting quirk, a couple of quirks, I should say. Not quite the Billy Ripken 89 Fleer problem, but Don Landrum, card number 43, Landrum played for the Chicago Cubs. Originally, his card featured his zipper down, and with his jersey pushed down through his, you know, belt loop through the front of his pants, you could actually see the button poking through. Some people thought this was not a button of a shirt, but let's just say part of the human anatomy. So Topps had to several times try to airbrush it out and make things look a lot better. So there are several versions of that card. None that are worth a ton of money, but there are different versions of it. Also, a rather morbid goof-up by Topps. Dick Ellsworth, card number 447, also with the Chicago Cubs. There was just something in the water about the Cubs and the Topps set that year. Well, it says Dick Ellsworth, but it's actually teammate Ken Hubbs. Well, you may say, well, that happens a lot. You know, they just put the wrong picture. The problem is Ken Hubbs died. So that is a rather unfortunate error in the 66 top set. So Ken Hubbs coming back from the grave and appearing in the 66 top set, despite dying in a plane crash back in 1964. Oops. So you have those little unique things there. And speaking of unique things, we've mentioned in the previous top sets, you had coins, you had embossed cards, you had iron-on rub-offs in there. You have pretty much the same thing in 66, the rub-offs, although from the pictures that I've seen, they weren't just the black and white cartoon character pictures of players. These were actually a little more lifelike, and it was basically, a little cloth patch, or not really cloth patch, but a special fiber, and the player's picture and name was backwards on it. And what you would do is, you know, put that under the shirt and iron it, and it would basically heat seal to the shirt until you washed it four or five times. So that is a unique thing that was thrown in addition to the cards and the bubble gum. So if you're one of those people that likes collecting the quote-unquote full set, not just the cards, but the little tchotchkes that were thrown in there as well, that's something that you can look forward to in 66 Tops. Now, as for the overall design, let's take a look at our random poll. Again, card number 119, Art Shamsky of the Cincinnati Reds. I believe this picture was taken at Al Lopez Field in Tampa, Florida, which is no longer there, where Raymond James Stadium is, the home of the Buccaneers. That's where Al Lopez Field used to be, the longtime spring training home for the Reds and the home of their Advanced A Florida State League team, the Tampa Tarpons. One of my favorite minor league teams. I did go to a lot of Tarpons games when I was a kid back in the early 80s. And the stadium was run down. It was not very picturesque. The drinking fountain water tasted like sulfur, which I'm sure probably altered my body and mind in ways I should not describe. But I have a lot of fond memories of Al Lopez Field, which was bulldozed back in, I want to say, like 1990 for extra parking for the old Tampa Stadium where the Buccaneers played, which I always thought was ironic because there were always 40,000 empty seats at the old Sombrero. But anyways, you've got roughly 85, almost 90% of the card devoted to the picture here. And of course, this being 1966, pretty much all the photographs were pose photos. Topps really didn't get into action photography until the early 70s in case there were many awkward photos, especially in the 73 top set. We'll get to that a few episodes down the line here. But here you have Art Shamsky just standing outside the batting cage. Again, it looks like at spring training in probably 1965, as he's wearing a beautiful Cincinnati Reds uniform from that era. Now, I mentioned the diagonal bar with the team name. It's up there in the upper left-hand corner. At the bottom, you had a little bar with the player name and position. And that was it. So while the 66 Topps set does not have the wow factor as 65 Topps, if you're a fan of simplicity and clean cut and, you know, not obtrusive, you know, nothing really getting in the way of anything, this is a set that you're going to love. It is very clean. It is very simple. Some will call it boring. I won't go that far. But again, when you compare it to the set that came before, it's not that, you know, really impressive, but it is very simple and clean and very easy to look at. Now, if we flip the card over, you will see that the back of the Art Shamsky card, first of all, featuring one of the problems that we talked about, the off-center cut. And you can see this with the front of the card, too, how the card is cut a little bit above where it should be. You can definitely see it on the back because of the horizontal presentation of all the stats and the text. It's clearly kind of pushed off a little to the right. So that was just something standard with 66 tops you just had to deal with. But one thing I like about the 66 top set is it is very easy to read. You have the solid white cardboard stock, one of the great features of these mid to late 60s top sets that I don't think really gets the credit it's due, because I think we're so used to the old gray cardboard stock that was featured in top sets for decades, even, you know, a few years before the 66 set came out. But I always liked the white cardstock because, first of all, it made the cards better quality, but it was also a lot easier to read stats if you were into that. You've got the white cardstock. You've got a very 1966, again, here we go with the Mad Men reference, a very business-like, very corporate look to the top of the card here. You've got the baseball card or the baseball number, the card number inside the Topps baseball, that's what I'm trying to say, along with a black box with the player's name and personal information. And then on the right side of that rectangle at the top of the card, you've got a neat little tidbit here. And this was very foretelling of the career that Art Shamsky would have in the major leagues. Art hit 6 homers in 13 games in 1962. And he would have these stretches where he would just sail the ball, you know, crush the ball out of ballparks. Even though he was not a regular player, he was a pinch hitter in most of his time here in the major leagues. So you have a neat little cartoon there. And like I said, in this rectangle that everything's in, it's a very 1966 look. And again, if you look through the pop culture, you look through the art, you look through some of the marketing and designs that were coming out in 1966, this is very representative of that era. Now, Art Shamsky didn't have much of a professional career at 1966, so his complete major and minor league stats at the bottom only take up maybe about an inch of the card. So there's plenty of narrative that's above that. For players like Mickey Mantle, who had been in the league since the early 50s, you didn't have much room for any kind of narration. You just had stats. But much like a lot of the sets in the 1960s, especially, you know, starting with 1963 and moving forward, this was pretty much of a standard template for the Topps company. You had a lot of stats horizontally presented. You had major and minor league numbers. And if room permitted, you had a little bit of narrative there. So it's a very sharp, clean, like I said, a corporate kind of business look. Nothing unsafe here. Nothing too wild. It was still a very nice, clean-cut look for Topps in 1966. As I mentioned, 65 Topps had a fun look to it. 66 Topps, the Topps people clearly buttoned up the shirt and straightened the tie once again, like they did in 64. So think of 64 Topps as the Thursday office card. Think of 65 Topps as the 5 o'clock Friday card. And then 66 Topps was the, oops, Monday morning, time to look prim and proper and let's get back to work on time. That's kind of the flow that they had here. So again, 1966 Topps, not exactly a card that just blows you out of your seat and you go, this is just an incredible card. It's got some good factors to it, but it's not one that you just kind of trip over your feet trying to assemble. With that said, I like the simplicity to it. I like the clean look to it. It's good, not great, but I should quantify good as being very good. You know, it's actually, it's not boring. It's not too blah, but it's a design that, even though it is simple and it doesn't quite live up to what we saw in 65 or 63 or 62 before it, it is still taking care of business and taking care of the purpose that is putting out a pretty good product. And I think Topps did that in 1966. And much like the 2013 Topps Heritage set helped me appreciate the 64 Topps set a lot more than I once did The same can be said for the 2015 Topps Heritage set, which was based on the 66 Topps design. Really, you know, the more I looked at the design using today's players and being able to have more of those cards in my hand than the 66 Topps, I've got probably about 20 cards from 66. I really appreciated it a lot more. I like the design. I like the look. And it's kind of like 64 Topps, too, in the way that at first you're kind of like, it's okay. But over time, you grow to like it more and more. It's not up there with 65, 63, or 62, but this is far from the worst effort that Topps put out. This is actually a pretty solid card with a pretty solid, simple design that still stands strong all these years later, despite not having the tremendous rookie class that 65 or 67 Topps has. So this is another one of those vintage sets where I say if you can find a lot of these cards, be it online, on eBay, or at a garage sale or your local card store, chances are somebody's looking to unload these cards for 30 or 40 cents a piece. If you can get, you know, a couple hundred of them for $20, go for it. Even if there's no stars in there, again, it's just a neat little piece of baseball history and baseball card history that I enjoy collecting regardless of the star power or the condition of the cards. And just to hold this piece of history in my hand, 66 Topps, pretty good set to do that with. Now, as for our random pull, card number 119, Art Shamsky. Like I said at the beginning of the podcast, if you ever watched Everyone Loves Raymond, you know that Ray Romano's dog was named Shamsky. So you've heard that name before, but did you know that Art Shamsky has more to his credit than having his name shared with a TV character's dog? He is actually in a rather unique company that includes Stan Musial, Mickey Mantle, Ralph Kiner, Hank Greenberg, Bo Jackson, Manny Ramirez, Troy Gloss, Albert Pujols, among many others. And no, they're not all Jewish like Art Shamsky is. A couple of them are. But he's in a very unique company there. Art Shamsky, pinch hitter extraordinaire, once hit four consecutive home runs in four consecutive at-bats, and what is rather unique about that feat, other than the fact that it's amazing, Art Shamsky was not a starter in either game where he hit those consecutive home runs. In fact, he missed a game in between the two games that he did that feat with. So that's something that goes back to August of 1966. We'll get back to that in a moment. But Art Shamsky alive and well and doing all sorts of things to keep his name out in the public, including writing a book. I'll tell you about that. Also doing real estate in the New York area. And if you're a Mets fan, you know who Art Shamsky is because he was one of the big reasons why the Mets advanced to the World Series in 1969. He had a tremendous division series against the Atlanta Braves. But first, Art Shamsky was a guy that you probably didn't imagine would be in the major leagues when he was growing up in the St. Louis, Missouri area. In fact, he was a guy that didn't really get into baseball until he was in high school. Now, he graduated high school early at the age of 16, went to the same high school as Kenny Holtzman, another famous Jewish sports athlete in Major League Baseball. And he was a guy that was kind of off the radar when it came to baseball, but he had a pretty successful year of baseball. When he graduated at the age of 16, decided to go to the University of Missouri. And as Shamsky would say, he wasn't a great player, but he was pretty good. Well, after a year of school at Missouri, he figures, you know what? I'm going to give this a try professionally, much to the chagrin of especially his mother, you know, your good old-fashioned Jewish mother, who as Shamsky would say. And this story, by the way, told by Eric Aaron of the Society for American Baseball Research at their website. Of course, his mother would want him to be a doctor or a lawyer. His sister did become a lawyer. His dad was also looking for him to reach greater academic levels in society, but because his dad was a big baseball fan, he's kind of like, oh, okay, yeah, that's cool. Why don't you go ahead and give pro baseball a shot? So he is signed by the Cincinnati Reds in 1959, and works his way up through the Reds farm system, which at that time included a lot of the key pieces to the team that would become the big Red machine. Of course, Pete Rose being one of them, Tony Perez as well. And while Rose was fast-tracked and made his way up to the major leagues in the early 60s, a lot of the other key pieces that Shamsky was a teammate of would eventually kind of go up the same path that he did. And that was, they didn't really make much of an impact until 65, 66, 67. Well, Shamsky would make his major league debut in 1965, primarily as a pinch hitter, but also playing several games in the outfield for the Reds. 64 games appeared in 1965, a .260 batting average, two home runs. So you look at just those stats alone from the 65 season, you're thinking, well, this is a guy that's probably not going to leave an indelible mark in Major League Baseball. But again, if you just look at the back of his card, you can see, not just with that trivial factoid about him homering six times in 13 games in 1962 when he was playing for the Macon Peaches of the Sally League. But if you look at his numbers while playing for the Pacific Coast League, San Diego Padres, this guy could hit the cover off the ball at 25 home runs in the 1964 season. Of course, that was enough for the people in San Diego to tell the people in Cincinnati, hey, this guy's pretty ready to go. You should give him a look-see. So this was a guy that could hit the cover off the ball, but there was some concern, is he one of those tweener guys that is going to be an absolute star at AAA but just can't quite make it work in the major leagues. So along comes the 1966 season, and it's very similar in terms of the number of games that Shamsky appeared in, the number of at-bats. He was primarily used as a pinch hitter or defensive replacement, but still appeared in 96 games for the Reds, 271 plate appearances. He hit only 231, but he hammered 21 home runs for 47 RBI. So when you look at that and you're thinking, hey, this guy is hitting a home run once every, how many at-bats did he have? 234 at-bats. So once every seven or eight at-bats, this is a guy that you can count on. And because he was a left-handed hitter, not only a left-handed hitter, but a left-handed power hitter, this is a guy that you could plug into certain situations if he was on a platoon system, and you could really work him to your advantage. Now, in the middle of this 1966 season, a pretty amazing occurrence happened for Shamsky in August of 66. It was during a series between the Reds and the Pirates at Crosley Field in Cincinnati. On August 12th, these two teams were just hammering the ball, the wind clearly blowing out towards I-75, the newly paved I-75, just beyond the outfield fence at Crosley Field. And the game would end up with the Pirates winning 14-11 in 13 innings. Well, that sets the stage for Shamsky's performance that afternoon. He's brought in the eighth inning as a defensive replacement in left field. Well, in the bottom of the inning, he hits home run number one to give the Reds an 8-7 lead. Well, the Pirates come back and tie it. So in the bottom of the 10th, Shamsky homers again to tie the game up. And then in the home half of the 11th, Pirates are up 11-9. Shamsky comes up for a third time and hits a two-run blast to tie the game at 11. So again, the Reds would eventually lose this game, but Shamsky was named player of the game because he hit three consecutive home runs and in a pinch-hitting role, or I should say a substitute role. You can only pinch hit once, but in a substitute role as a defensive substitution, well, he comes in and offensively, he's just setting the world on fire. Well, he doesn't play on August 13th, and that was a rain-shortened game. So then on August 14th, he is again called in late in the game. This time he's called in as a pinch hitter, not a defensive replacement, but he comes in, pinch hits for Johnny Edwards, the Reds catcher, and he hits a two-run home run. So the Reds not only get a brief advantage in this game, but Shamsky has now hit four consecutive home runs. And to make things even more interesting, he not only ties this record for hitting four consecutive home runs, but he does it all as a pinch hitter. Now, the other players to hit four home runs in four straight plate appearances over multiple games, I mentioned some of these names, Mickey Mantle, Stan Musial, Ralph Kiner, Hank Greenberg, some other names, Sean Green, Troy Gloss, Bo Jackson. There are several others who have done it. But that is just absolutely amazing. And of course, you know, the Reds were kind of on edge. Would he, the next night, August 15th, would he be able to hit a fifth consecutive home run? He wasn't able to. He actually did hit a base hit, but everyone was kind of let down because they just thought that this guy was in a zone and was going to be popping these balls over the fence all the time. So it's pretty impressive. And you heard that company that he was with. Pretty impressive to hit four consecutive home runs in four consecutive plate appearances. It's even more amazing that he did it, first of all, with a day off between those games because of the rain-shortened game, but also in a defensive replacement or pinch-hitting fashion. You know, he's just sitting on the bench until the eighth inning, and then, you know, the manager throws him out in left field, gets three home runs over the extent of a 13-inning game. Next day, he sits out. Next day, he's just sitting there until the eighth inning, gets thrown in as a pinch hitter, and again goes yard. So quite the performance for Shamsky in a season where, if you look at the 1966 stats, you may think that there's nothing really special there, but he really had a special stretch in that series against Pittsburgh in the middle of August that season. 1967 comes around, very similar numbers, 76 games played. Mostly in the pinch-hitting role, 147 at-bats, only a 197 batting average, and his home run production dips quite a bit. Well, the Reds had seen enough of him, and they decide to trade him to the Mets. Well, this is kind of disturbing for Shamsky on a couple of fronts. One, because this was his first career trade. So he signs with the Reds in 1959. You think you're going to be with the Reds forever. Well, 8 years later, he's finally traded. The other disturbing part was the Mets were still a laughingstock and still cellar dwellers in the National League back then. Well, fortunately for Shamsky, as any baseball historian will know, right around this time is when the young talent of the New York Mets started getting better and better. And of course, eventually that team that would become the world champion Mets of 1969 and a contending Mets team for the next several years, well, they were all coming together at this exact same time. So with Shamsky's experience, as part-time as it was, he did have a little more experience than some of the younger guys that were being called up through the Mets farm system. So he arrives in New York, and the funny story behind this is Bing Devine was the GM of the Mets who pulled this trade off, and Shamsky, like I said, was a little upset about the trade happening. So Devine calls him up, says, oh, you know, the Mets are a really, you know, up-and-coming team, and you know, they're really going to, you know, stand out for many years, and you're going to be a big part of that. So Bing Devine sells Shamsky on why he should be excited about playing for the Mets. Well, 2 days later, Devine resigns as the GM of the Mets and goes to the Cardinals to become their GM. And, you know, here's Shamsky reading about it in the paper a couple days later. He's like, wait a minute, this guy was extolling the virtues of the New York Mets and me playing for the Mets, and he skedaddles out of town a couple days after me. Well, even though Devine made his hasty exit, things still worked out rather well for Shamsky, and he got a lot more playing time. You know, he wasn't just a pinch hitter, but he was, especially under Gil Hodges, who was managing the Mets at this time, he was much more of an integral part to a multifaceted outfield. The Mets had five or six outfielders that they had on the roster that they utilized in certain situations against certain pitchers, certain defensive matchups. So Shamsky really got the most of his career with the Mets. 116 games in 1968, a .238 batting average, but again, 12 home runs, 48 RBI. Fewer games, fewer plate appearances in 1969, but still a very productive season for him. 100 games, 303 at-bats. He batted .300 that year and still provided some pop at the plate for the Mets with 14 home runs and 47 RBI. But the real story for Art Shamsky that season, as I alluded to before, his performance in the National League Championship Series. Now, 1969 was the first season for the Championship Series. It was the first time after the expansion of 1969. You just couldn't have two 12-team leagues, and then whoever finished at the top at the end of the year, that was your, you know, your pennant winner, and then you would have the two face off in the World Series. Of course, with television dominating baseball at this point in time, and with the owners set to receive more money through gate receipts by having an additional level of the playoffs, this set up things really well so that once you had the expansion, you could then split the leagues into six-team divisions, have a playoff there. It was a best of five series that would then lead to the best of seven World Series between the National League champion and the American League champion. Well, the first division winners in 1969 on the American League side, you had Minnesota and Baltimore. Of course, Baltimore would come out of that into the World Series. On the National League side, you had the Mets and the Braves. And of course, 1969, the first of, 25 seasons of Major League Baseball where the Braves inexplicably were in the National League West, even though they were nowhere near the other Western teams, but I digress. So the Mets not only clobbered the Braves, I mean, they just swept right through them in three games. And one of the big reasons was because of Art Shamsky. And Shamsky was not in a pinch-hitting role here. Like I said, Gil Hodges liked to platoon players, and he just liked the matchup that Shamsky provided against the Braves' pitchers and the defensive shifts. In three games, Shamsky had 13 at-bats, 13 plate appearances, seven hits, only three strikeouts. He scored three runs, knocked in one run. So this was a guy who could very easily set the table. In fact, he was a guy that often was the first man up for some of the heavier hitters of the Mets lineup to bring him around. And of course, when you had a pitching staff that included Tom Seaver, Jerry Kuzman, a young Nolan Ryan, you also had Tug McGraw in there. You didn't need a whole lot of runs. So if you had a productive enough crew, you could set the table, get just enough runs across the plate, and let the pitching staff take care of the rest. So with that 7-for-13 performance, Art Shamsky hit .538 in that National League series and pretty much should have been the NLCS MVP. Now, the World Series comes around, and Hodges didn't necessarily like the matchups of the Baltimore Orioles with Shamsky in the lineup, so he was pretty much relegated to a pinch-hitting and defensive replacement role in the 69 World Series, appeared in only three of the games in that series, had six plate appearances, and had zero hits. So he didn't have quite the impact in the World Series in what would prove to be Shamsky's only postseason appearance in his career. And I should mention, he was able to have this really productive 1969 season despite dealing with a host of back injuries. In fact, he suffered a herniated disc. If you've ever had a herniated disc anywhere along your spine, it is very painful. Well, imagine trying to play baseball through that pain. And there were even some professionals that said that Shamsky would never play again because of the disc that he blew out and the complications he had of it. So he actually missed a good portion of the first couple months of the 1969 season, had some injury rehab in Norfolk with the Tides that year, but he was still knocking the cover off the ball in Norfolk. So, the Tides personnel are going, wait a minute, you need to get back up to New York. You can help out the Mets more than you can help out us. And that was a very fortunate turn of events for him because he was able to cobble together a pretty decent season. In fact, statistically, you could say his best season, even though he didn't hit the most home runs in his career that season. He had the most complete season, and he had that incredible postseason run against Atlanta, eventually getting him that World Series ring. Pretty productive 1970 season, hit .293, 11 home runs, 49 RBI. The most games and most plate appearances in his career that season at the age of 28, 122 games, 403 at-bats. Then in 1971, only 68 games, 135 at-bats, a .185 batting average, 5 home runs, and only, how many RBI? 18 RBI. So he wasn't as productive, wasn't being used as much as before. So at the end of the season, he, along with Jim Bibby, Rich Folkers, and Charlie Hudson, were traded to the Cardinals, his hometown team, for a collection of players, Jim Beauchamp, Harry Parker, Chuck Taylor, and Chip Coulter. So he gets to go back to his home state, his home city of the St. Louis Cardinals, but his time with St. Louis was actually very short-lived. In fact, he was cut at the end of spring training, so he never suited up for the Cardinals in 1972. He did, however, a few days later, get signed by the Chicago Cubs, had a very, very, very brief tenure with them, appearing in just 15 games and hitting only .125, got released by the Cubs in June of 72. He was picked up by the Oakland A's, but had an even more brief tenure with the Oakland A's, appearing appearing in just 8 games. And just a few weeks later, his season was done. His career was done. Released by the A's in July of 1972. So follow the bouncing ball from October of 71 to July of 72. Goes from the Mets to the Cardinals. Doesn't suit up for the Cardinals in the regular season. Gets cut at the end of spring training. Goes from the Cardinals to the Cubs. The Cubs to the A's. And, you know, Mama didn't raise a foolish boy here. Art Shamsky went, you know what? this is it. I can't bounce around much longer. And he ended his career in 1972. Now, much like many other former ball players, he dabbled in broadcasting a little bit, was actually part of the Mets broadcast team back in the early 80s as a color analyst. But as I mentioned, he went into real estate. He's a real estate consultant. He also wrote a book about the magical 1969-1970 era in New York. It's called The Magnificent Seasons. He co-authored the book with Barry Zeman, the story of the Mets run in 1969, the Jets run, the end of the 68 AFL season, winning Super Bowl III in 1969, and of course the New York Knicks championship 69-70 season. So again, if you're looking to see what Art Shamsky could do as a writer, the book is called The Magnificent Seasons, co-authored by Barry Zeman, Z-E-M-A-N, and that book was released back in 2004. Now, another interesting side note here, and I mentioned how Shamsky is a Jewish baseball player, along with his former classmate in high school, Kenny Holtzman. Well, Ron Blomberg would join these two gentlemen back in 2007. They managed a new Israel Baseball League. So he managed in the Israel Baseball League, or the Israeli Baseball League, I guess you could call it, a league that only lasted 1 year. They weren't able to make it a long-term deal, but he managed the Modin Miracle, finished third place in a six-team league. They played a short season. They only played 41 games. So the league couldn't quite make it. However, according to our friends again at Sabre, Art Shamsky still makes the occasional trip over to Israel to promote baseball and to try to, you know, spark up things once again, trying to get America's pastime there in Israel. Now, even though he is far from a Major League Baseball Hall of Famer, he is a member of the New York Jewish Sports Hall of Fame, also the National Jewish Sports Hall of Fame. So as much as you would like to think of that joke from the movie Airplane about Art Shamsky being part of the pamphlet of professional Jewish athletes, he certainly made a name for himself with that stretch of 3 games where he hit 4 consecutive home runs, all as a pinch hitter. He made a name for himself during the 1969 NLCS, and well after his playing career, in the midst of a business career as a real estate consultant, still went halfway around the world to promote this great game in Israel. So quite the career, and not bad for a guy who didn't really pick up playing organized baseball until he was in high school and didn't really decide to make a go of it until he was done with his freshman year in college and just went, you know what, the studying things for the birds, I'm going to make a go of it professionally. And, you know, he was able to time things out perfectly. He was a very talented player, and especially when called on in a pinch. But he was able to make things go along with some very talented teammates, first in the Cincinnati farm system, next with the New York Mets in a team that won the World Championship in 1969. So there you go, the lives and times of Art Shamsky, hitter of 4 consecutive home runs in a time period in 1966, 4 consecutive at-bats. A hitter of a .530 batting average in the 1969 NLCS, which helps propel the Mets to the World Series, and a man who is not only a real estate consultant now, he is also an author. He is also a manager in the Israeli Baseball League, or at least was several years back, and has also dabbled in broadcasting a little bit with the New York Mets. And like I said, still alive and kicking at the age of 75. Art Shamsky, also known as Ray Romano's dog on Everybody Loves Raymond. So there you go, card number 119. He's also, John Stewart has a dog named Shamsky, so it's contagious. Jewish comedians naming their dogs after the Jewish juggernaut, Art Chomsky. And our look at 1966 Tops, the good but not great set following the outstanding set from 1965. Now we have another good but not great set in 1967. And like 66, and I'll even say 64, there are some good things you could pull from the 67 set. There are some not so good things, but overall, a pretty good product that was put out. Again, though, this was kind of during a dry period of creativity for Topps. They didn't really produce some of their best cards in the mid to late 60s, and they didn't really ramp up the designs until the early 70s. So we will look at the set that had some tremendous rookies, even if it didn't have a tremendous look, in our next new podcast that will be next Tuesday at 10 a.m. Eastern. We will send that out. In the meantime, between now and then, we've got the Flashback Friday episode that will be coming your way. And also, you can comment about this show or anything else going on in the hobby at our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.